the Moment Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Leadership under the microscope. While California makes it official for residents to stay home, Governor Gavin Newsom looks east to D.C. for the federal funds to keep the state afloat and healthy. Plus, while you don't have to stay cooped up 24/7, you might be wondering where the best places are for some fresh air social distancing. Well, it's all coming up on Take Two, so stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. It's Friday. It's been a very busy week, so let's just jump right into it with State of Affairs, our weekly look at politics in California.
This is a moment where we need some straight talk, and we need to tell people the truth.
Governor Gavin Newsom tells California to stay home, issuing a dire prediction if people fail to act. Meanwhile, as thousands face economic uncertainty here, Senate Republicans pitch a $1 trillion coronavirus package. That's a trillion with a T. We're going to get into those developments and more with Zach Corser, co-director of the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College, and Christina Bellantoni, professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Welcome to you both. Let's just dive right in. Christina, Governor Newsom called for all 40 million Californians to stay home yesterday, and he painted a very grave picture of what might happen if we do not. For those who have been struggling to keep up with all the latest developments, what stood out to you the most from Gavin Newsom's speech yesterday?
Yeah, and the main thing, I think, you know, with both California and New York, but especially our state, we lead, right? This is, if anyone has listened to any medical professionals or scientists over the last few weeks, this is necessary. And even that, we know it's still going to be bad. And so seeing California take these steps, I could see a lot of other states, you know, just sort of the reaction was, you know, thank you. And yes, it seems very extreme. And yes, there are a million unanswered questions. And it's really difficult. And it's a lot of pain. And for especially that it doesn't have an expiration date, I think makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, including, you know, all of us. We're all affected by this. But at the same time, you know, we can lead and potentially make this not quite as bad. And I will point out that dire picture that he pointed out, you know, his office didn't really provide the math for that. And then in addition to that, there isn't really a projection of if we take these draconian measures, what will happen? And could that actually make it better? And I think that's what I'm hopeful for. And certainly, while it's inconvenient, it's what my family has been attempting to do for the last week as it is.
Yeah. Christina, do you think some states that maybe aren't seen as states that are on the front lines of this, we're really hoping that some state somewhere would step up and make that first move, and that way they can just follow suit?
Well, and I think you're going to see that with New York. Certainly, there are plenty of states that haven't made really any adjustments, and that will matter because where there are not borders, this could get worse. And I just I do believe that when you take the nation's most populous state, where there are so many cases, where things are so fluid, where the economy is, you know, so huge, all those things, and you take these measures, it says, look, you know, we're taking this very seriously. We know this is going to be a huge hardship, and we're going to do it anyway. You know, with schools, everything else, it is big, and it does lead.
Zach Corser, Governor Newsom also said that California needs more than $1 billion in federal funds for things like unemployment insurance to Medicaid. And just an example, on Tuesday, he said the state received 80,000 applications for unemployment. The average is about 2,000. So looking at the employment situation, what has Newsom reported and what have you been seeing from data that's starting to come in?
Well, the numbers are startling, but perhaps not surprising. We're just in the starting movement here of all these different regulations and attempts to keep people from circulating and protect people from spreading the virus, which is causing, you know, major disruptions, obviously, and particularly in the service economy. And, you know, California is not alone. In Ohio, just over the last week, we saw unemployment requests go from 7,000 to 80,000, and in Minnesota go from 4,000 to 50,000. So there's going to be a huge number of people who are unable to work, and it's going to cost a lot of money, frankly, to get these people either in some other type of work or to give them the support that they need. There's been discussions in Congress right now as part of the bailout, you know, should we increase unemployment funding or should we do direct payments? And it's actually interesting that Labor Secretary Scalia has actually said that it's better to get these payments out directly, because with this volume of unemployment filings, it's just going to be really difficult in terms of administration to get through all these. So direct payments seem to be a preferred method to actually help.
And Christina, when we're talking about vulnerable people, one of them right now, one class of workers that are vulnerable are independent contractors, and many have said that businesses have dried up really in recent days. And that has sparked a new debate among people on both sides of AB 5. That's the law that extends employee classification status to gig workers. What are people arguing now?
Well, effectively, that, you know, this is an even more justification to make people like Uber or Lyft drivers employees that are eligible for benefits. But that also that law was so restrictive that it's put people under even more potential hardship, right? And, you know, it extends, it's far beyond drivers. You know, I know from the media industry, this has created a lot of concern among journalists who are doing freelancing. And, you know, then there's the argument that probably there's going to be more gig work available just with the strangeness of these times. You know, there will be people who are looking to pick up jobs because they've been laid off from a permanent job. So it is complicated. And I get a sense, you know, I think that the courts are going to have something to say about this. Obviously, there's a potential ballot measure against this. I mean, I think, you know, that there's a whole question about whether people will even be able to get things on the ballot, given the process for doing that is collecting signatures on a petition in person. So all of those things, I think, throw this, you know, very much in question. But, you know, when you just think about, we all know people and we know the scope of what this is going to do to the economy, what it's already doing to the economy, it is enormous, and it is every type of worker.
And Zach, yeah, this has already, without the pandemic, the debate over AB 5 has been raging. But how does this pour gas on a debate that really was something that was enveloping the state?
Well, yeah, I mean, these issues were far from resolved from either side. What's interesting to me is, you know, it tends to be this issue looks sort of binary from a distance, where either, you know, someone is entirely an independent contractor or they're an employee. But, you know, in moments like this where people are being put out of work, it's important to remember that independent contractors are not eligible for unemployment benefits or state mandated sick leave. And when you think about, you know, we could talk about Uber, but other sorts of independent contracting that requires you to be in contact with people who may have COVID, and then industries that are severely impacted by drops in number of passengers. I mean, it's really worrisome, the lack of protection that does exist for independent contractors. And I wonder, and I hope, sort of like what's happening in Washington, that both sides could maybe see a third way here, where there can be protections offered and people can pick up gig work without the sort of expense that's required under AB 5.
Now, Christina, going to that $1 trillion relief package. First off, what is Mitch McConnell proposing right now, and how confident are you that a deal can be done quickly?
Well, you know, it is Congress. So, you know, while this is urgent for them and it has hit very close to home with two lawmakers that we know of testing positive for this, there's also, you know, always political incentive to continue fighting. Right. I think that you're going to see people argue about the scope of, you know, any type of industry bailout. Right. I think people want to see help for small businesses. I think there is a lot of traction for what Elizabeth Warren has been talking about, with, you know, executives not being able to get this, or there being some sort of guarantee that there won't be layoffs. But at the same time, there's so much uncertainty. How could you possibly know that? We don't know how long this is going to continue, or how bad it will be, or if all domestic travel will be limited, all those things. You know, if there will be a nationwide stay-at-home order, any of those things, I think, will really immediately affect, like, these numbers. $1 trillion, like, could very well not be enough. And certainly, you saw after the crash when the stimulus package in 2009. I mean, that was one of the things that President Obama was criticized for, was, you know, it could have been more. And that was a huge political fight at a time when everybody knew people needed it. You know, the taxpayer money, you know, personally, I'm glad that it's not going to that many people who have higher incomes. But you also have to keep in mind, particularly here in California, you know, we know that you might have a high income, but your housing costs are so
expensive
huge
to live
that, like,
here,
actually, that's not. Yeah. So, and I don't like the provision that if you aren't liable for federal income taxes, meaning you're a low wage earner, that you don't get it, because most of those people are the people that are the most vulnerable. And, you know, certainly can use the help at this moment. People are very, very close to the edge financially.
Yes, yeah, so it sounds like, Zach, that if a deal does come down, it probably won't make everyone happy. And Republican Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana said, we're all going to have to vote for something that in another environment we wouldn't support. So what do you think? I mean, considering what's at stake and the politics involved, will Congress act with the people in mind on this?
I think so. And I think it's, you know, Congress gets pretty low marks these days. But I, you know, I have to say, looking at like phase two, for example, which was largely negotiated in the House under Speaker Nancy Pelosi's leadership. And, you know, there were objections in the Senate. Mitch McConnell wasn't happy with everything, particularly the paid sick leave provisions. But ultimately, the, you know, Republicans signed off on this bill. And I think Republicans are hoping it will go the same way in the other direction. Mitch McConnell has set a deadline for Monday to put this up for a vote and send it to the House of Representatives. And I think there's a hope there that, you know, despite disagreements, you know, where Republicans tend to be concerned about small business and corporations and bailouts, Democrats are very concerned about corporate abuse, that this money could go to stock buybacks, and that the focus will not be on worker protection. There will be disagreements. I think this will be something that both sides won't fully agree with, but I think there's no doubt, as we see what's happening in California, New York, and around the country, that they have to decide this. And I do think you are going to see a bill next week that we can call phase three, that will bring a lot of relief to the economy and a lot of reassurance to Americans.
All right, let's move on now to a report from the New York Times that says four senators, including California's own Dianne Feinstein, sold large amounts of stock based on inside information as federal officials publicly downplayed the threat of coronavirus. Christina, how has Senator Feinstein responded?
Well, a couple things. You know, she said that she has many, many trades she isn't aware of because they're in this blind trust. And I have some things to say about that. And then she also said that this particular Senate intelligence briefing behind closed doors that would have potentially provided her with information that could have been affected in the stock market because of coronavirus, that she actually didn't attend. You know, that's the pretty brief statement she put out on Twitter. I will say, as you may know, I was the editor of Roll Call for many years. One of the things that Roll Call does is they compile the annual Wealth of Congress ranking. It is extremely tedious. Most of these forms, especially all 100 senators, are not required to file their forms online. So they are literally handwritten in some cases. You have to go through hundreds of thousands of pages. And Dianne Feinstein is the second wealthiest person in California's delegation. And I think she's like number five in Congress, something like that. Or at least she was the last year that I did this for the LA Times, for the LA Times and for Roll Call, because the LA Times did the California ranking. And so these forms you go through and you see, I mean, there are literally hundreds upon hundreds of stocks. And also the fact that we even know this is because the senators are required to disclose major transactions, right? And they're she's the 10th wealthiest member of Congress, or she was the last time that I participated in this ranking. You know, in the year that I worked on this for the LA Times, you know, she had made one big transaction worth $25 million for a hotel property, right? I mean, that increased her wealth by $13 million, right? So these are huge numbers. And, you know, again, the individual assets in here, I mean, you can actually go look at this if you go to latimes.com/projects/how-much-are-they-worth. It's all there, and you can see, I mean, a huge number of these are owned by her spouse.
The blind trust run by her spouse, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Coral Growth Investments for at least $50,000. So there's just, it is very difficult to understand the scope of these, and I would just say I'm glad that there is some transparency that we know when senators make stock transactions, and they might not be on the up and up, and it's good that journalists are looking.
Christina Bellantoni, professor at USC's Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Stay safe, you two. Thanks for being here.
Thanks,
you too,
likewise.
Abe. Thanks.
Governor Newsom's stay-at-home order for all Californians marks a major step in the fight against coronavirus. As Californians look to an uncertain future, we wanted to check in again on someone who's far from home and in a far worse situation. KPCC listener Regina Honorato has been keeping us updated on her life in Milan, Italy. Today, that country reported 627 coronavirus-related deaths in the past 24 hours. The military has now been called in to enforce a countrywide lockdown. Here's Regina.
In the past few days, things have gotten even more dire here in Italy. The deaths surpassed China, and the peak in the disease here was supposed to be the day before yesterday, but now it's been postponed until next week. It's hard to imagine how it could get even worse than it is. Now the restrictions for going out are even more stringent. I went out for a walk last night and it was dead quiet and empty. It was very eerie to be in a space that's normally so full of life without anyone at all. As for me, I'm feeling a lot more stressed about this. I got an email from the American Embassy in Rome advising Americans to come back now while we still can, and that transportation going forward is going to be even more limited and that we can't expect any sort of help from the American government. This put some pressure on me as to whether I should stay or go, but I am trying to handle that decision as logically and pragmatically as possible. Also, I just don't want to like bring anything back with me from Italy. My life is here, my partner is here, my job is here, and it feels foolish to leave all that when this is kind of the only certainty I have. My main fear is just that something will happen to someone in my family, especially my mom, because she works in healthcare, and that I won't be able to go back if I want to. But at the moment, I don't really have any choice but to take it one day at a time.
We're bringing you the latest coronavirus coverage as well as ways to stay occupied, entertained, and engaged through all of this. That's why today, when you donate $5 a month toward KPCC's spring fundraising goal, we're going to thank you with five digital movie rentals on Fandango Now. You can stream movies that have been in theaters as well as other popular films. And your gift, your donation, supports our ability here at KPCC to be there for you no matter what, no matter when the news breaks. So please give as generously as you can at kpcc.org. And thanks.
Well, it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, even you don't know by now. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, baby, it'll never do somehow. When your rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm a-traveling on, but don't think twice, it's all right.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The LA County Department of Public Health announced 64 new coronavirus cases in a press conference this afternoon. Now, if that number seems small, Director Barbara Ferrer said her department is preparing for many more in the days to come.
New York City, which has about 8 million people, reported 2,000 new cases in one day. My team is preparing for managing a situation where we, too, might see 2,000 cases in one day.
Though that seems grave, it's important to understand the potential risk, especially given the news we received last night that most Angelenos should expect to be homebodies for at least a month. LA leaders announced orders that officially close certain businesses, along with providing instructions on where and how residents can move and gather through the area. Since then, the Twitter hashtag Lockdown Los Angeles was trending, which may lead to some confusion about what's allowed and what's not. LA County Supervisor Catherine Barger is here to explain what this all means for you. Supervisor, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, it feels like we've already been living this way for a bit. What finally pushed the county to make this distinction official?
Well, as we get more tests out there. We know the numbers are going to go up, which is what Dr. Ferrer said today. So, you know, we saw them go down for the last 2 days, and they spiked up again today. We're getting more and more tests out there, and the results are coming back. So we know that we've got to get, and I'm saying ahead of the curve, but we're not even looking to get ahead of the curve. We're looking to flatten the curve, because the biggest fear that we have is that we're going to have cases where they're going to need to be hospitalized, and we're not going to have the infrastructure in place to support it in our hospitals. So our goal is to spread or to slow down the spread. And the best way to do that is to tell people they are safer to stay at home.
Now,
it's not a lockdown.
Yeah.
It's just safer to stay at home. And you can go to the market, keep social distancing in place. You can go to the hardware store, social distancing. But please, please, please limit where you go in order to try to decrease the spread of this virus.
Yeah, and seeing a hashtag like that on social media, like Lockdown Los Angeles, got to be frustrating for you, because that's not what this is, as you mentioned. It is not a lockdown. At its core, what can people do and what should people not do? At its very, very core.
Well, at its very, very core, people can go for a walk. They can go to open space. You know, they can go to the park. They can, basically, I tell people to reconnect with people you haven't talked to in a long time. If you need bread, go to the market. If you need something, and by the way, there is plenty of food available. So people should not want to go and clean out the market. Recognize that we continue to make sure that the distribution centers have access to everything they need so they can get the food back out there to get restocked. Go about your life, only do it at home. We don't want people congregating in common areas, because we all know that this is a very, very, very easily spread disease. And so it's important for us to educate the public. And when I hear hashtags like that, it creates a lot of anxiety amongst people. And Mayor Garcetti and I, and then with Mayor Garcia and with Mayor Tornik last night, our goal is to let people know this is not about lockdown. This is about asking you to stay home, limit the amount that you go out. And in return, we will be able to actually prevent people and save people's lives potentially by slowing the number of cases that are coming online.
Supervisor, why the differences in the orders between the county and the city? For example, the city orders its residents to remain indoors with exceptions, while the county does not specifically order that. So why not line up the city and the county together?
Well, actually, that is the goal, and they are lined up, quite frankly. The city really drilled down and gave more explicit in terms of what their interpretation was. But we've worked closely with the city of L.A., city of Pasadena, and city of Long Beach. And people ask why Long Beach and Pasadena. It's interesting to understand that Long Beach and Pasadena have their own public health department, so they've got their own public health officer. City of L.A. does not, although the mayor has the ability to make these type of orders. So what we decided, in order to avoid confusion, we're all on the same page. So, you know, whatever anyone's interpreting in the city is applying in the county as well. They just drilled down and really this is exactly what we mean. But they are all intended to be the same across the board.
Because I keep looking at the difference. The city bans all gatherings outside of home. County bans gatherings of 10 or more with exceptions. So that's why it just I can already picture it leading to even more confusion.
So what I'll say is, I mean, the county has said 10 or more is a big no-no. And I know that the city has upheld that as well. When we do safer at home, that means we want you to stay at home. And I understand the confusion, and we are, you know, what I was just interviewed, and I told people this is a fluid document. And quite frankly, as people call in and say, well, what about this? There are nuances that we have not thought of. Mm-hmm. And so we are trying to be as responsive as possible, but also responsible as possible to ensuring that we are, number one, not cutting off something that isn't essential that we hadn't thought of.
Right.
And number two, being responsible in that we want to make sure that we do not put in place something that is going to increase the spread of this disease or this virus.
One last thing. Everyone's looking to you and other leaders for answers. But now that we've got some answers, I'm wondering just you personally, Supervisor, how are you doing through all this?
You know, I have to say I've got such an incredible team in my office, but also with my colleagues on the board, and I'm doing fine. I mean, you know, this is what being a public servant's about. I mean, I understand.
You're a person too, Supervisor. You can't escape that part.
Believe me, I am a person, but I have an incredible support network around me, and I have great friends that are calling me because they are trying to understand. You know, I'm taking it fine. I mean, this is what I signed up for, and quite frankly, I wouldn't have it any other way.
That's Los Angeles County Supervisor Catherine Barger. Thank you very much. Yesterday, during a press briefing, President Trump doubled down on calling the coronavirus the Chinese virus. He's defended the use of the label by saying that the virus comes from China. However, the only thing that's generally agreed on by experts so far is that the first reported cases of COVID-19 were in the city of Wuhan in the eastern part of the country. The president insisting on the name largely ignores criticism from the Asian American community and others that the term is racist and anti-Chinese. Asian Americans have reported racial slurs and physical abuse as a result of China being thought of as the source of the virus that causes COVID-19. Stuart Kuo is the founder of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles. He joins us now to discuss what's been happening. Stuart, welcome.
Thank you, Abe.
Now, I'm sure you've heard the president. What's your reaction to him calling COVID-19 the Chinese virus yet again?
Well, I was outraged by his comments and his doubling down on the term Chinese virus. I think it's really part of a blame game that he's playing, but it has a very dangerous effect and a dangerous diversion from what we need to concentrate on, and that is our public health safety.
What are the consequences of this particular rhetoric?
Well, the rhetoric fans the flames of racism, xenophobia, stereotyping. We've already seen incidents where school children have been beaten up. There have been many cases of abusive behavior, people being called out, and the term Chinese virus is part of the calling out. So we've seen an uptick in these kind of hate incidents are all around the country, not just in Los Angeles, but throughout the country. And we hope that there isn't a very serious killing, but we've already seen where Asian Americans are fearful for their lives. I had a friend who I was speaking to last week, and he saw a line of people trying to buy guns, and half of them were Asian Americans. So it's really having a very disastrous effect in the country. You could call it collateral damage to this blame game to blame China. But it's very dangerous for Asian Americans, especially Chinese Americans, but it's affecting Asians across the board.
We're talking to Stuart Kuo, founder of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles, talking about the term Chinese virus. Could you speak from a historical perspective? How have Asian Americans and Chinese Americans in particular, how have they been scapegoated during times of unease like this? What are the consequences historically?
Well, we've seen historically where Asian Americans are stereotyped and grouped together. Of course, in the 1870s, Chinese were blamed for the Depression, and that ended up in the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882 that was passed by the U.S. Congress. Of course, Japanese Americans were labeled as disloyal in the 1940s, and it ended up in the unjust incarceration of 120,000 Japanese Americans, many of whom who were citizens of the U.S. In recent times, we've seen the Vincent Chin killers in 1982. They targeted a Chinese American man who was supposed to be causing unemployment in the auto industry in Detroit. And then, of course, in 2003, with the SARS epidemic, we saw Asians being targeted where Asian businesses lost customers and Asian Americans sometimes were beaten up.
So we're very on edge about this kind of stereotyping, and it's a disaster for Asian Americans, but it's really a diversion from what we all need to be concentrating on, and that is our public health and safety.
Well, that's what I was about to ask you, Stuart, because thinking about what the president says and how he uses that term, the impact of dealing with the crisis that we're going through now, how does that affect that?
Well, you know, when he uses that term, it's used in a divisive, derogatory way. And he's not going to say, oh, the Chinese vaccine or the Chinese treatment in a positive way. And yet there's so much we can learn from China and some of the countries that have gone through a few months of this horrific public health crisis. For example, if you look at the news and you see the line of public health workers taking the swabs of people to test them for coronavirus, assuming they can't get the test, you know, some of them just have a face mask or half a face mask. There's very few of them have a head-to-toe protective gear, but that's what they're doing in China. It's head-to-toe. Everything is covered. And so there's a lot that we could learn, but if you have such negativity, you're just not going to learn from it. So it's a major opportunity lost.
Sure. One last thing. What is it that you want people to hear from this conversation that we're having right now to make sure that they have in their heads?
Well, we set up a website, Stand Against Hatred. And so we're asking people to give us their stories, to let us collect the stories. We will be talking to different legislators to make sure that they stand up for Asian Americans. And we would like to connect with members of other business groups and unions and et cetera, so that we can spread the word that it's just unacceptable to label a whole group and in a divisive way.
Stuart Kuo is the founder of Asian Americans Advancing Justice Los Angeles. Stuart, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Now for another mid-show moment of Zen. With so much going on these days, it can be hard to find a little peace of mind. So, as often as possible, we're going to bring you encouraging voices from the community to help slow you down, take a breath, and then find that peace. And these voices are of the Chino Hills High School Chamber Singers. The group was supposed to sing at a choral festival last Wednesday, but that was canceled out of precaution. However, they still wanted to perform, so they got together on video conferencing, recorded this lovely rendition, and posted it on YouTube. We'll share a link to this video from our Twitter, at Take Two. And remember, once these hard times pass, there will be a rainbow on the other side. All of our coverage of the coronavirus pandemic comes to you without a paywall on LAS.com and also without our traditional spring member drive, which we canceled because we know how important the news and facts are you in times like these. Thing is, we cannot cancel our need for funding. So for a donation of just $5 a month, we'll keep our newsroom strong as this pandemic continues. So please, $5, if you can spare it, please become a new sustaining member and increase your support at kpcc.org. You could also call us at 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. We really need you right now. And thanks a lot. More Take Two coming right up. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Even though many people have been told to self-quarantine, cabin fever can set in pretty quickly. Now, the good news is that in Los Angeles, the county's public health department says things like taking a walk or going for a hike are perfectly okay things to do. And during yesterday's announcement of a statewide order to stay at home, Governor Newsom stressed that getting a breath of fresh air is just fine.
You can still take your kids outside, practicing common sense and social distancing. You can still walk your dog.
Now, while it might not be the best idea to go to a typically crowded place like, say, Runyon Canyon, there is plenty of open space in L.A. So for some advice on how to get outdoors while still staying at least 6 feet away from other people, we turn to Casey Schreiner, founder of the site Modern Hiker. He's also the author of the forthcoming book Discovering Griffith Park and a Local's Guide. Casey, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, Casey, by the way, I want a copy of that book. That book is right up my alley. Make sure I get one.
Coming to you.
Thank you very much. All right. Now, you just made a post about hiking in a world where we're supposed to maintain some distance from each other. What are some of the new guidelines you'd suggest?
Right. So as you mentioned at the top there, this is kind of a thing that's changing kind of minute by minute. So right now it's okay to hike in Los Angeles. But as you mentioned, you don't want to go to those crowded places. That social distancing is key here. So the first thing is to not travel in a group. Nix that hiking group that you hang out with. The Sierra Club has canceled all their stuff. If you're going to travel with someone, it should be basically someone that you live with or that you spend a lot of time with kind of in close quarters already, and then maintain that safe social distance, that kind of 6 feet away from other people. And then you don't want to pick a trail that's crowded. So you don't want to pick something like Runyon or something around the observatory in Griffith Park. You want to go a little bit off the beaten path. And ideally, if you can find a hiking trail that is a wider trail, like something on a fire road, as opposed to a single track trail, you'll give yourself a little bit more breathing room when you're trying to pass other hikers.
Well, let's talk about Griffith Park for a second, because there's certain parts of Griffith Park where it might not make sense to head to, but biggest city park in the entire United States. So what are some of the more acceptable parts of Griffith Park that maybe are okay to try and hit first?
Yeah, so I don't know the exact numbers on this, but I'm a frequent hiker in Griffith Park. I live in Thai Town just below it. And to me, it seems like probably 80% of all the foot traffic in Griffith Park is kind of focused around the observatory. Yeah. So I was just hiking in the park last week between some rainstorms, and I started up through Ferndale, went up Western Canyon and kind of did a loop around Mount Hollywood. And really around the observatory was the only part that was really crowded. If you go towards the north side of the park or even the eastern side of the park, start hiking near Mineral Wells or up near Travel Town, you're going to find much less crowded trails generally.
Yeah, right around Mineral Wells, if you go on the hill above it, that's where Amir's Garden is. And
yes.
If you want a place, hopefully there's not a lot of people there, but if you want a place just to relax for a second and take a breath, that is an incredible spot to go. And you mentioned the north part, so that's Burbank, right? Burbank is bordering
yes.
that part of Griffith Park. Those trails are actually pretty good if you wanted to find a place where there's not a lot of people.
Yeah, and also, it really depends on where you are in LA. Another important thing with this order is to stay local. People might think, oh, now's the perfect time to go check out Joshua Tree or take that planned trip to Zion. It's not. Those gateway communities there are really not equipped to handle the extra foot traffic from hikers and travelers. Even Inyo County recently just posted, hey, please stop coming to Lone Pine and to Bishop and to Independence, because if something happens to you, our hospital systems can't take care of you. But if you're out in the western part of LA, there's lots of great stuff in the Santa Monica Mountains, the Santa Susanas up near Rocky Peak. Santa Susana State Historic Park has great wide trails. The Verdugo Mountains has an excellent trail system of very wide fire roads. And south of the San Gabriel Valley, I also recommend the Puente Chino Hills. Down near Whittier, it's probably going to be a little bit more crowded, but that trail network extends east all the way into Chino Hills State Park in Orange County. And there's lots and lots of room down there to explore.
Casey, I don't know if you are old enough to know who Yogi Berra was.
Yankees
catcher, Hall of Famer. But he had a phrase that I'll paraphrase here. No one goes there anymore. It's too crowded. So that's what he loves doing, that malaprops is what they were, or yogiisms. But when it comes to, like, if you show up to a place that you think, okay, there's not going to be that crowded, but you start to see a lot of people there, is it best, you think, at that point to kind of just either find another place or try again another time?
Yeah, I would definitely recommend trying another trail. I would say don't be afraid to turn around or go somewhere else. You know, LA does have a really, really big amount of open space. It's not evenly distributed throughout the city, but anywhere in the San Gabriels, anywhere in the Santa Monicas, you can find something that is not going to have a crowd on it, especially if you're going early, if you're going during the week. And really, one more thing I want to reiterate is to kind of let's save some of those really adventurous hikes for later. You know, the hospitals right now don't want to deal with your sprained ankle because you tried to scramble up a waterfall. Even the Pacific Crest Trail Association basically told people, hey, if you're on the trail, you should probably get off now and cancel your plans if you're going. And that's a pretty big deal.
Casey Schreiner, founder of the site Modern Hiker and author of the forthcoming book, Discovering Griffith Park, A Local's Guide. Casey, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much. Stay healthy.
All right, more Take Two coming up in about 60 seconds or so, so make sure you stay with us.
Good morning or evening, friends. Here's your friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love in need of love to.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. You know, yesterday morning, I went to the store to stock up on some things that I'm low on. Stood in line for an hour. When it opened, everyone rushed to the toilet paper aisle. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a lone bag of beans on a shelf by itself. I couldn't believe it. Like a thirsty man seeing a glass of water. I ran for it, got it, and managed to do some more shopping. But it's scary, right? Because it makes us all think, are we just running out of beans altogether? KPCC's Jacob Margolis has been digging into the bean supply chain to tell us where the hangup is. Hello, Jacob.
Hey.
So where does the story of a bean begin?
Yeah, so all across the U.S. and Canada, under these beautiful blue skies, last May, farmers planted like more than 1 million acres, almost 2 million acres of them. And from May through August, like all of our little beans, they popped up from the soil and all their bean friends got plumper and plumper until sometime between September and November. And that's when farmers like this guy I talked to named Bob Dombeck out in Minnesota, they all went to go basically test out their beans to see if they were between 15 to 20% moisture, which is perfect for storage.
You can go out there and chew on them and tell where the moisture is at just by chewing on them.
Yeah, so they were pulled from the field by these giant combines. They're sent to a processing facility. They're cleaned and they're put into these giant silos for storage until they're needed. I talked to Dave Hartman. He's a manager at one of those facilities for Kelly Bean, and he is feeling very good about those right now.
We have a warehouse plumb full, and our bins are still half full, so we're good to go. And then there's two other bean plants in this town, and they're full to the max too yet. So,
when they're needed, all of these beans are packed from these silos into these like 2,000-pound giant nylon bags, or they're just pumped into big train cars and then shipped off.
Now, you just can't roll those trains of beans up to La Cienega and Santa Monica Boulevard and empty them into people's homes.
I mean, that would be pretty...
be ideal, pretty cool. Right?
I would take that. But that is true, and this is where the big bottleneck is right now, because those beans have to be packed. The companies have to hire workers to do the packing who are now working around the clock. They even have to buy more plastic bags with like logos on them to put the beans in. The supply chain, it simply was not ready to handle this big rush. And by this time of year, usually bean sales slow down because like who wants to eat beans in what's going to soon be 100-degree heat?
Yeah.
But the next step is after they're packed, it's just getting them to people. And that part of the system, it's had to scale up really fast, according to Joe Perez, the senior VP at Goya.
If you're planning or you're running a trucking fleet and you're hauling 100 loads a day, and that's on Monday, then suddenly Thursday, you encounter requests and demand for 300 trucks a day. Where do you get the drivers? Where do you get the equipment?
He said they've seen a 4-to-5-fold increase in bean demand, and they could meet demand if people stopped panic buying, which he said the government could help by like calming people down. He thinks they could be doing a better job. That said, he does believe we will get there.
I believe it will calm down sufficiently that walking to a supermarket will not look like you're going to Venezuela or Cuba in the next month or so, yes. Yeah.
When we do get more beans, though, chances are they'll be kind of ugly. They'll be maybe a little shriveled. They'll have some divots in them. The color maybe not as perfect. And that's because last year there was a 30% hit to bean supplies because of the weather. And the weather made a lot of these kind of beans, these final load of beans that we're getting for the year, made them a little uglier. And worst case scenario, you know, I imagine this, like there's one person who eats the final bean and all the stores are empty. If we did run out of bean stores, which no one told me that we would across the bean industry, we've got to make sure that we can make it to next harvest season, which is in September.
All right. So, Jacob, what are you making with your beans?
We just make beans and rice. We throw like orange, bay leaf, cumin. But Craig Kelly from Kelly Bean, who, you know, like he's a bean guy, he knows about beans. He told me about this recipe.
I mean, if you want to be lazy, you just buy a box of like Betty Crocker brownie mix. You take one can of beans, or you cook them from dry state, and you just mix it in. That's all you do, and you cook it. It just makes them more, they're a lot moister. Yeah, so you get your protein and your sugar all in one shot.
That's KPCC's Jacob Margolis. Jacob, thanks for that recipe. I'm going to try it.
I'm sure you will, eh?
All right, finally, another Friday and another week of social distancing. But even though it's best to avoid crowds, you can still have fun this weekend in Southern California.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran and A. Martinez. Last week, I shared some great things to do inside, like shows to stream and video games to play. Today, I've got some expert advice on board games to play, even remotely, and great podcasts to binge.
All right, let's start with those podcasts, because I'd love to hear something that, just for a little bit, takes me away from the news.
So I called up my friend Melissa Locker. She's reviewed podcasts for The Guardian and Newsweek. She's got her own newsletter about podcasts now, and one she suggested for families with young kids is a fiction podcast. It's called The Unexplainable Disappearance of Mars Patel.
Which tells this amazing story about a group of young children who get taken off on an adventure through space.
The main character is 13-year-old Mars Patel. That's spelled P-A-T-E-L. And the mystery is that his friends keep disappearing.
5 days. 5 days what?
5 days since Aurora disappeared. She isn't responding to texts or calls. She hasn't posted anything on Instagram all week.
It's pretty exciting and good for all ages. One of those podcasts that parents can listen to without wanting to tear their hair out.
Hasn't posted anything to Instagram. My goodness, Leo, of course, send out the army, right? All right, now what about something for adults? Perhaps maybe a podcast to keep us all calm.
So Melissa suggested a podcast that's all about words.
The incredible Helen Zaltzman just did a great episode of her podcast, The Illusionist, which does a series on soothing words, just words that make you just calm and cool and collected.
Almohada, it's pillow in Spanish. Alpaca, alfia.
So yeah, that episode is literally just her reading calming words with that British accent. It's kind of like ASMR meets the dictionary. And if you want to listen, that's Illusionist, as in A-L-L, like a literary illusion.
I always thought my name was soothing. A. Martinez. All right, forget it. All right, let's move on to something more interactive. Board games, because some of us have been really bored.
So I talked with Will Wheaton. He helped create International Tabletop Day for all the games you play on a table. And he suggested a game for older kids that can go for days on end. It's called Mice and Mystics.
You're a bunch of mice, and you start out living in, like, the farmhouse. And the first couple adventures are you getting out of the farmhouse. And every mouse has a different ability. So one is a wizard, one is a thief.
It's very much like Dungeons and Dragons, but it's made to be accessible to kids of all ages, and it can be played over multiple days, which is kind of a good thing since we might have to isolate ourselves for weeks here.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, okay, then there's some games where people can play them remotely over video conference.
Yeah, Will suggested party games that don't require a board, since that's kind of hard to coordinate over long distance.
Something like Apples to Apples or Cards Against Humanity, because those are more about the social aspect of talking and chatting and enjoying your company. And the game is just sort of like an excuse to be getting together.
So doing that, it just requires that all parties have a copy of the game in their home so they each have a pool of cards.
And what about a game in case only one household has the game in hand?
So I talked with Jeff Bryson. He runs Next Gen Games in Mid-City. He suggested this game called Codenames, which is about trying to reveal spies. So cards are laid out with different words like radio or moon, which represent aliases. And the goal is for each team to guess which aliases are spies for their own team. So the house with the game just needs two people to be team leaders. Then their teammates are the ones on video conference.
You can have a bunch of people, as many people as you want in like a stream, and two people on opposite teams are giving out clues to their team members, and everyone could look in on a camera and they don't have to interact with the cards.
Maybe you and I can play, since if people can't tell, I'm actually working from home too. But A. Martinez, here's a code name. Leo has a cat. That's me on Twitter if people want to share other things they're doing this weekend too. And we've got more ideas up on LAIST, from soothing YouTube videos to some great series on streaming. That's LAIST.com.
That's KPCC's Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, A.
All right, it's that time of the week when we give a shout-out to the people who make Take Two possible. Special thanks, though, due this week. Most of our staff has had to work from home while coordinating with their colleagues here to put on the show this week. And this week, the show was produced by Lori Skywalker-Galaretta and Leo Duran. Austin Cross produced and directed the show. Ari Saperstein and Kevin Tidmarsh helped us out this week. Our senior producer is Megan Larson. And I'm A. Martinez. Take Two will be back on Tuesday of next week. I got to tell you guys, the whole staff, we've kind of been burning the candle at both ends, not having much time for anything else in terms of family and saying hello to them. So we're going to take Monday off just to kind of regroup and recharge for a second. So all things considered, it's going to start early in our place. We're going to keep you covered, though, with all the news. So make sure that you tune in to 89.3 KPCC. Thanks. Talk to you guys next week.